Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We will begin with the riots, arson and looting in Baltimore after days of peaceful protests following the death in police custody of Freddie Gray. Kenneth Burns, a reporter for WYPR covering Baltimore City and Baltimore County, joins us. He is a member of the National Association of Black Journalists and has been on the streets of Baltimore covering events as they have unfolded over the past few days. Then we will speak with Michelle Gilman, a professor of law and the director of the Civil Advocacy Clinic at the University of Baltimore. She is the past president of the board of the Public Justice Center and a member of the Committee on Litigation and Legal Priorities for the ACLU of Maryland. We will examine the racial divide in the divided city of Baltimore, where African Americans make up 2/3 of the city but are less than 1/3 of Maryland's population. Then we'll examine the late Freddie Gray's neighborhood of Sandtown, which has more residents in jail than any other neighborhood in Baltimore. Mark Schindler, the executive director of the Justice Policy Institute, who worked as a public defender in Baltimore's juvenile court, joins us to discuss the choices young black men face in a neighborhood where there are 84 men for every 100 women, with many black men between the ages of 25 and 54 either incarcerated or victims of homicide. Then finally, we will look into the Supreme Court's deliberations on same-sex marriage and speak with Mark Solomon, the National Campaign Director of Freedom to Marry and the author of Winning Marriage, the inside story of how same-sex couples took on the politicians and the pundits. He was in the court today, and we will discuss what the arguments might reveal about how the ruling expected in late June will come down. And joining us now is Kenneth Burns, a reporter for WYPR covering Baltimore City and Baltimore County. He is a member of the Society of Professional Journalists, the National Association of Black Journalists, and the Online News Association, and also writes about Maryland politics at mdpoliticsblog.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Burns.
Thank you for having me.
And President Obama came out rather strongly today condemning the rioters who looted stores in Baltimore and said that they should be treated like criminals. And now, of course, I think in a couple of hours at 10 p.m. local time, a curfew goes into effect, and there are, I believe, up to 5,000 National Guards are going to be taken to the streets. So tell us about what you're seeing now in Baltimore a couple of hours before the curfew begins.
Well, things were relatively calm today compared to this time last night. You had people cleaning up the mess of the looters. In fact, that took place earlier this morning. You still have a heavy police presence out, but things are much, much calmer.
And what do you think of the president's remarks in terms of basically condemning? I mean, first of all, things started out a few days ago very peacefully, didn't they? So what is the explanation, if there is one, for why suddenly things turned violent?
That's what everyone is still trying to figure out, because for a good solid week there has been peaceful demonstrations and peaceful protests. And then starting Saturday evening, we started to see some of the more violent protests. Between Monday and Saturday, Monday was the worst between the 2 days. Sunday, you didn't really have the protests that we saw on Monday or even Saturday. It was still kind of quiet, but everyone is still trying to figure out what happened to cause such damage.
And one of the explanations I've heard is that some of the local street gangs, the Crips and the Bloods, got together and decided this was a good opportunity to strike. Is that in any way an adequate explanation?
That's part of it, but as it turned out, as we learned last night, according to the gangs, they did not have a pact. There was a, during the Freddie Gray funeral, there was a Baltimore police press release that said they had credible information to believe that a threat was issued against law enforcement, and it was due to a pact between the Bloods, the Crips, and the Black Guerrilla family. Well, we had some of those gang members in Baltimore last night saying that they don't have a pact. They would not have done anything like that.
So when President Obama harshly criticizes this, what he refers to as a handful of people, for senseless violence and destruction, and went on to say that is not a protest, that is not a statement, they are stealing. I guess he's referring to the footage of people looting the CVS pharmacy.
Yeah. And in fact, a lot of people that they're referring to those who looted the store. They're not even calling protesters, and I'm going based on at least my Facebook feed where they said yesterday was not a protest, that was just a bunch of people just acting up.
So in terms of the earlier events, I take it that the people that were out protesting, you know, legitimately, and again, Obama went on to say today that the issues in terms of our Black Lives Matter and police killing unarmed black men, this has been a slow-rolling crisis. Did those protesters show up again today, and that the burners, the looters, the arsonists, and the thieves sort of laid low today? Is that what happened?
That's what it sounds like. The people who genuinely wanted to see peace, the ones that genuinely wanted to see justice in the case, they kind of just went out and started helping to clean up what the looters had trashed.
I see. So what's your sense then of you've got a whole week now of curfew with the military on the street. And that hasn't happened in Baltimore since 1968, after the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King. Having military troops on the streets is pretty surreal to begin with, isn't it?
There was a lot of surreal moments since this weekend, to be honest. I was with the protest on Saturday night, and seeing how things unfolded, that was surreal. And then, by way of disclaimer, I actually live about a couple of miles from where the riots sort of took place and took over. Watching it all was just surreal.
And again, I'm speaking with Kenneth Burns, who's a reporter for WYPR, covering Baltimore City and Baltimore County. He's a member of the Society of Professional Journalists, the National Association of Black Journalists, and the Online News Association, and also writes about Maryland politics at mdpoliticsblog.com. So it's a bit odd, and we were talking about being surreal, the idea that an anti-brutality protest, anti-police brutality protest should end up not so much brutal, but certainly a criminal. And your sense then is that even though things are quiet, what about this neighborhood that Freddie Gray comes from? It sounds as though conditions there, and we'll be talking more about it later in the program, but I take it that Sandtown, is that the neighborhood that you often saw in the famous TV series The Wire?
The Wire was mostly based on the East Baltimore, not necessarily West Baltimore.
I see. So give us the geography then. Sandtown is in West Baltimore. That's the poor neighborhood with the highest incarceration rate. Where was the CVS, and where were the most of the protests?
Most of the protests and the CVS was actually outside of Sandtown. The CVS that we all saw set ablaze, it's still in West Baltimore, but a little further east from Sandtown, or further east or further north. And then the protests riots, when they just began, they were a little further up from CBS, and it's around that Northwest Baltimore or West Baltimore line. So you have that. So you have this 2 mile, I'm gonna say 2 or 3 mile radius between the CBS, the mall, which also has the subway station at the corner of the mall, as well as the church where the funeral for Freddie Gray took place.
And there is this divide, is there not, in the city of Baltimore between the majority African-American population and the minority white population?
It's more economic as opposed to racial. That's the best way I could describe as far as the divisions. Police Commissioner Anthony Batts did comment recently on how Baltimore has this reputation of being racially stuck in the 50s.
And how do you think the last few days' events are going to affect that dynamic? If you're stuck in the 50s, this is kind of back to the 60s by the sound of it.
There has been a lot of comparisons to the 60s. Our city council president, Jack Young, and others, they've brought up the comparison between now and 1968, which, as you mentioned, was the last time the National Guard was brought to the streets of Baltimore to keep things calm and peaceful and maintain order. But most of the divisions today seem more economic than racial. It's definitely not like Ferguson. Let's say that. But as far as the divisions, they're more economic than they are racial. And speaking along those lines, keep in mind Baltimore has a majority black power structure. The police chief is black. The mayor is black. The city council president is black, and the majority of the council is black. But here we are, still having the seemingly same issue as Ferguson.
Well, Kenneth Burns, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Burns, who's a reporter for WYPR, covering Baltimore City and Baltimore County. He's a member of the Society of Professional Journalists, the National Association of Black Journalists, and the Online News Association, and also writes about Maryland politics at mdpoliticsblog.com. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the racial divide in the divided city of Baltimore.
Because a few of them were white, and it's the same across the nation, black and white discrimination. Yeah, and you can't understand me, and all that other jazz they hand me in the papers and TV, and all that mass stupidity that seems to grow more every day. Each time you hear something it would say, you want to go and do your in, cause the color of your skin just don't appeal to him, no matter if it's black or white, because he's out for blood tonight.
Your pride, telling lies, that you're not on your own. Watching faith in prayers will make you see.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michelle Gilman, who's a professor of law and director of the Saul Ewing Civil Advocacy Clinic, as well as co-director of the Center on Applied Feminism at the University of Baltimore. She is the past president of the board of the Public Justice Center and a member of the Committee on Litigation and Legal Priorities of the ACLU of Maryland. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Gilman. Michelle, are you there? What happened to Michelle?
I'm here.
Oh, there you are. Hi, Michelle. So,
thanks for having me.
Thank you. And Michelle, the neighborhood of Sandtown, where Freddie Gray comes from, and where I believe he was arrested, and we still don't know what happened to him and how his spine was snapped, but it happened in police custody, and unfortunately, they haven't been particularly forthcoming with the details. And of course, in the vacuum, I think people get angry, which is clearly what's happened over the last few days. Let me just run by some statistics that I've found on Sandtown in Baltimore. Half of the people between the ages of 16 and 64 are out of work. The unemployment rate is double that of the city, at 1 in 5. Median income is 24,000, which is below the poverty line for a family of four. And nearly a third of the families live in poverty. Meanwhile, somewhere between a quarter and a third of the buildings are vacant, compared to 5% in the city as a whole. So, just reading that, it's a pretty devastating picture. Does it look that bad?
It does. If you drive through Sandtown, Winchester, it's a bleak picture. As you said, there are so many vacant and abandoned buildings. Baltimore is a city of row homes, as you may know. That's the predominant housing structure. And it's really heartbreaking to drive down the block and see so many vacant and abandoned buildings. And every now and then there's an occupied building. And often the resident of that row house takes a lot of pride in their building and may have, you know, plants on the front stoop or other, you know, decorations. And on either side of their home, just boarded up nothingness. So it's very apparent when you drive through Sandtown, Winchester, that this is a community in distress.
And in terms of the what I mentioned a minute ago about Freddie Gray's death, there was cell phone video of the arrest, and he was screaming in pain, and apparently his spine was snapped, presumably at that moment, but they haven't been very forthcoming about what happened. Obviously, in the vacuum, and as the days go by, these peaceful protests turn into violent ones. So what explains the tardiness in getting all the facts out so that people, you know, could perhaps, you know, dampen people's anger? To provoke their anger. You never know.
I can't speak for the police department, obviously, and how long this is taking. I suspect on their behalf they do want to do a thorough investigation and not rush to judgment. But you're right that in that vacuum, a lot of anger is boiling over. This isn't the first incident of its sort in Baltimore by any stretch. Recently, the Baltimore Sun did an excellent investigation that they called Undue Force. And, you know, they uncovered that just over the past 4 years, more than 100 people had won court judgments or settlements related to allegations of brutality and civil rights violations. And those are just the people who won, right? Not just all the people who had, you know, filed complaints or expressed concerns about it. So the horrible incident that happened with Mr. Gray is part of an ongoing stream of incidents that residents are aware of, and the frustration about how they feel they're being treated by the police department and the sort of follow-up investigations and due process that happens, they're not feeling fairly treated. So in a way, it was probably just a matter of time.
So just going back a little bit in the history of Baltimore, I mean, first of all, just in terms of the racial divide, the city of Baltimore has African Americans make up 2/3 of the population of the city, but they're less than 1/3 of Maryland's population. Mm-hmm. But the city itself was a fairly prosperous, particularly with Bethlehem Steel throughout most of the last century, and of course it boomed during World War II, and there were still a number of big manufacturing plants. But now, with outsourcing and globalization, I guess, there's been a hollowing out. Is it sort of a rust belt area? Is that how you describe it?
Well, I don't think in Baltimore we consider ourselves part of the rust belt, but right. A lot of the dynamics are the same. Between 1950 and 1995, our city lost 100,000 good manufacturing jobs that helped build a good middle class for both whites and blacks in Baltimore. And the jobs that are replacing those are low-paying service industry jobs, by and large. And at the same time that manufacturing jobs were leaving, there was also a lot of white flight out of the city. And so you have multiple dynamics working together that leave a real lack of opportunity behind.
And again, I'm speaking with Michelle Gilman, who's a professor of law and director of the Saul Ewing Civil Advocacy Clinic, as well as the co-director of the Center on Applied Feminism at the University of Baltimore. She is the past president of the board of the Public Justice Center and a member of the Committee on Litigation and Legal Priorities of the ACLU of Maryland. So when you mentioned, of course, the Baltimore Sun, of course, it was very much a part of that great TV series, The Wire, which was both about journalism and city politics and the police and the failed war on drugs. Let me ask your opinion. What did you think of that series, and how accurate is it in terms of the dynamics and politics of Baltimore?
Well, I think the series was brilliant in its focus on how institutions impact people. I'm not sure we ever saw anything on TV like that before. And I think it definitely reflected a lot of what happens in Baltimore. It didn't reflect as much Baltimore City's strengths, and those are also not being shown during the media coverage that we're facing now. Baltimore is a city of very strong, independent, sometimes quirky neighborhoods with very committed residents. Today, people were out with brooms cleaning up from yesterday. People were handing police water and snacks, and that's the part of Baltimore that I'm not seeing on CNN during this, and that wasn't really shown in The Wire, because The Wire had a different mission and a different story to tell. But I think it's important for listeners to know about the strengths of Baltimore. It's called Charm City for a reason. There's a lot going for Baltimore, and it's heartbreaking that, you know, one night of rioting can really obscure so many positive things that are happening in Baltimore and so many people who are working hard to make those things happen.
But you're going to have the National Guard on the street for the next week, starting at 10 p.m. tonight. So that's an optic. That's a picture that takes you back to the 1968.
Absolutely. And it's people are anxious about it, and you know, you sort of have this feeling you're under a state of martial law. I guess you are, in a way.
So I assume in a week's time the dust will have settled. And what kind of reckoning do you expect? Because as our previous guest pointed out, most of the political office holders in the city are African American. Is there what kind of political reckoning will there be, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, through the peaceful protests that are happening, citizens are really making their frustrations known, and I feel that leaders are listening, and my hope is that this opens up a dialogue and opportunities, particularly to serve Baltimore's youth. I'm hoping we can make something positive come out of what's been a really stressful and trying experience. You know, there was a really interesting report done by the Justice Policy Institute showing that Maryland taxpayers spent $288 million on corrections in Baltimore to incarcerate 7,800 people a year. And, you know, they posited, and I think wisely, what could you do with that money? You could really do a lot. You know, they noted that for that cost of sending just one person to prison for a year, Baltimore City could pay for half of a high school teacher's annual salary, or employment training for seven people, two-bedroom apartments for 30 families for a month, or a GED course for 37 people. And so maybe this is the kind of dialogue we can start having about better deploying our resources to help people rather than to punish people. That would be the best-case scenario of what could come out of this, because I think the people, the everyday average citizen, is being heard, and that's a good thing.
Well, as it happens, Michelle, following you on this broadcast, we have Mark Schindler, the executive director of the Justice Policy Institute.
Oh, that's wonderful. So, and I'm sure he'll, you know, really be able to elaborate on those points. When they issued their report, you know, is really a powerful thing for those of us who work with low-income communities, and very helpful. So I'm delighted to hear more from him.
And tell me, what was your reaction, though, I don't know whether you saw the amazing piece of footage of the African-American mother wailing into her son, who she caught joining the looters. And then, of course, you know, the CVS pharmacy, one of the problems that you have in the inner city, and you have them certainly have it here in L.A., is getting stores in there instead of these sort of liquor stores that overcharge people. So that seems very counterproductive.
Right. It's hard to imagine what any looter or person destroying property could possibly think that message sends. As you note, the CVS, like any business in Baltimore, it's a source of jobs for people in the neighborhood. You know, it's a place where a mother might go to buy, you know, diapers or milk. There's a senior citizen center actually very near that CVS where a lot of people go to get their prescriptions filled. It's a resource. And destroying it destroys that resource for the community and just sends a terrible message. That was very heartbreaking to see, and a lot of people are understandably very upset by that.
So do you think that there will be a movement then to, you know, to balance incarceration against education, because they do seem to be mutually exclusive? Why spend all that money incarcerating young African-American men when you could prevent it by, you know, education and job opportunity? I mean, that's the assumption.
Yeah, that's absolutely the solution. And there are some innovative things going on in Baltimore that, you know, I'm sure your next guest can talk about. But we need to be more and more committed to that, absolutely. You know, speaking of Sandtown Winchester, you were giving us those interesting statistics before. And, you know, one of them is that 33.7% of the people in that neighborhood have less than a high school diploma or a GED. So clearly education is one of many solutions that could better things in Sandtown Winchester and in Baltimore City as a whole.
So I guess Martin O'Malley's he's running for president. This is not going to help him. But, you know, I when I was in Washington recently, I met with a congressman who's son of a former senator, Sarbanes. And I was very impressed with him. Do you know him?
I do. He was on the board of the Public Justice Center that I served on as well.
Yeah, well, I thought he was one of the more promising young politicians that I've met.
Absolutely. I totally agree. We're very fortunate in Maryland to have some politicians who really understand the challenges we face, but also the great promise within our state. I mean, there is definitely an irony here that Maryland is the most affluent state in the country, and yet the poverty rate in Baltimore is so extreme. The poverty rate in Baltimore City is almost 25%. Maryland statewide, it's less than 10%. We are really a state of extremes right now, and breaching that income inequality gap is going to be important to us also moving beyond the issues we've seen this week.
Well, Michelle Gilman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me, and I really appreciate you discussing these issues.
And again, I'm speaking with Michelle Gilman, who's a professor of law and the director of the Sol Ewing Civil Advocacy Clinic, as well as the co-director of the Center on Applied Feminism at the University of Baltimore. She is the past president of the board of the Public Justice Center and a member of the Committee on Litigation and Legal Priorities of the ACLU of Maryland. And joining us now is Mark Schindler, who is Executive Director of the Justice Policy Institute. He previously worked as an assistant public defender in Baltimore's juvenile court, representing children in delinquency proceedings, and he chaired the Juvenile Law Committee of the Baltimore City Bar Association and served on the Maryland Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Justice and the Committee for Baltimore's Children. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Schindler.
Thank you for having me.
And the area from which the victim of what appears to have been police brutality, Freddie Gray, Sandtown, the neighborhood that he comes from, the statistics about it are extraordinary. First of all, 34% of residential property in Sandtown is either vacant or abandoned, and that there are 84 men for every 100 women, and the black men between the ages of 25 and 54 have effectively vanished, mostly due to incarceration or homicide. Is that your understanding?
It is. And, you know, we recently completed and issued a report that looked specifically at those indicators that you noted for communities throughout Baltimore, but particularly in the Sandtown community where Freddie Gray was born, grew up, and was arrested in as well, and then subsequently died. And, you know, unfortunately, what we found is that was a community and is a community that is very, very challenged and stressed. The other thing that we found is, it, in some ways, maybe not surprising, it's the community with the highest number of individuals from Baltimore who are incarcerated in Maryland state prisons at an extraordinary cost of about $17 million a year to incarcerate people just from that community of Sandtown.
And could you make the case that if that $17 million had been spent elsewhere on education and opportunity, it would make a difference? I mean, that's the challenge here, for example, in the state of California, where we spend more on prisons than we do on education. And by the way, the biggest lobby now in Sacramento is the Union for the Prison Guards.
That's right. And so, you know, I don't think we can sit here today and say that if the money had been spent differently, that Freddie Gray would be alive. But I think we can say that it would be less likely that he would have been in the circumstances that he was in and that so many members of that community are. And so the fact that we're in Maryland spending $17 million a year to incarcerate people from that community, I think does raise the question, are we getting the best value for those public investments, or are there other ways that we can more effectively spend those resources? And you mentioned education and, you know, workforce and housing. Those are all very significant issues within that community. And so I think we are convinced that there are better ways we can spend those dollars. And what we also know is that prison gets very poor outcomes. And so that's not a good investment of public dollars.
And what do we know about, we've all seen The Wire, and that definitely probably puts a lot of this into context. And it was one of the best shows on television that I've ever seen. But how accurately to your mind, since you've spent a lot of time in the city of Baltimore and you've worked in the public defender's office with the juvenile courts representing delinquent children, the juvenile law committee of the Baltimore City Bar Association, and you've headed up the Maryland Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Justice and the Committee for Baltimore's Children. So how true does it ring to you?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a big fan of The Wire as well. I think it's one of the, you know, best pieces of television that we've had in many years. And so I think in many ways it has captured the character and the culture of Baltimore. Not exactly, of course, it is drama and it is TV. But, you know, clearly there are neighborhoods and people who are very much struggling. And what has developed over the years is a culture within the law enforcement there that is anything but community-oriented policing. I think they're trying to change that now. I think the new chief that's there, unfortunately, who is, you know, sort of over a very, very difficult situation, I think is trying to change the culture, but it's very entrenched. And so we have an entrenched police and law enforcement culture in Baltimore, and we also have entrenched long-time poverty and all the issues that come with that. And so it's not a good combination, and unfortunately creates, I think, conditions that are ripe for the types of things that we're seeing now in that community.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Schindler, the executive director of the Justice Policy Institute. I don't know whether you've seen the footage, Mark, of the African-American mother chastising her son, who's dressed up in black with a balaclava, obviously bent on looting, and she's absolutely wailing into him. And it sort of leads you to the idea that children in those neighborhoods either have a choice to, you know, put their nose down and study hard and get out of the neighborhood, or more often than not get enticed into the gang war, either through brutal coercion or through the fact that they see gangbangers running around with all the flash clothes and the big cars. So is that the choice that these young men face?
Well, you know, I don't think the choice is probably that clear, but I think there's no question that what we haven't done as sort of responsible adults in our communities and, you know, leaders at the state and city level is we haven't been successful in creating opportunities for young people where they have better choices and where they are getting the guidance they need to transition into successful adulthood. And so, you know, I think what we're seeing in Baltimore over the last couple of days, I think largely is a relatively small number of people who are, you know, expressing their frustration and their anger in ways that we would, you know, hope that it wouldn't. But that said, it's completely understandable, I think, the frustration that's been pent up in that community for a long, long time. And I think it is incumbent upon all of us to ask the hard questions. How can we do better? And that includes how can we spend our resources more wisely.
But my understanding is that these riots were led and directed by these street gangs, the Crips and the Bloods. We have them here, of course, in LA as well. And my understanding about gang culture, even though it's often glorified in music and videos, etc., it's essentially a form of organized crime around distribution of drugs.
Well, I don't think it's clear yet what led to the disturbances in Baltimore. Again, there were days and days of very peaceful protests. And so I commend the mayor for her restraint. I know she's under a lot of pressure right now for not acting more forcefully, but I think their initial measured reaction was right. I think we've seen in other places, and you think of Ferguson, where we saw a situation where the, you know, very quick response was an extraordinary show of force by law enforcement, and that clearly just escalated the situation. And so, you know, while I think we're all very concerned about what happened in Baltimore over the last 24 hours, I think we also have to recognize that it had been a number of days of peaceful protest, and that's important that we note that as well.
Well, I imagine, did you work for the governor of Maryland who's running for president? Well, he hasn't officially announced, but there's no secret. Martin O'Malley?
I did not. I was working in Baltimore with the public defender's office when he was mayor of Baltimore for some period of time.
Well, I was just going to say that he certainly appears to have been something of a casualty. He had to cut short his visit in the UK and has been asked some difficult questions. So there was a sense that things had improved under him. So how do you rate this upheaval now? Is this something that is, you know, what they call an isolated incident, or is this an indication that improvements have been reversed?
Well, I think it's clearly not an isolated incident in Baltimore. There have been, and the Baltimore Sun has documented quite well, a series of very troubling incidents of excessive force and abuses by the Baltimore City Police Department. And that dates back to when Governor O'Malley was mayor and since. You know, I think what we're seeing now is this is part of a larger national conversation that was, you know, in some ways very much sparked by Ferguson and then Eric Garner and what happened in Cleveland. And so, you know, in some ways the sad truth is that the Freddie Gray matter, it's not the first situation that we've seen in Baltimore like this. It's just the first one since these others. And so I think we're seeing, a simmering and a, you know, acknowledgement across the country that people need to recognize what's going on and speak out. That's everything, you know, the president and the attorney general and others, I think, have started to be very forceful on these issues.
But in terms of the incident itself that began the protests and then the protests turned violent just over the last 24 hours, what do we know about what happened to Freddie Gray? And the fact that we don't know about it would indicate that either people are sitting on information or it's not clear. But surely, isn't that the most important thing in these situations, is to get some clarity? I mean, the recent shooting in South Carolina, I think, because it was captured by a citizen on a cell phone, settled that case very quickly, didn't it? And you didn't have the kind of social explosion in Charleston that you're having in Baltimore.
Yeah, no, you make a very good point. So the investigation is still ongoing. We know some things, but clearly there's not all the information that has come forward as it should. And Maryland is an unusual state at the moment because of what is referred to as the Police Officer's Bill of Rights, which is a framework within Maryland that gives police officers certain rights in terms of how long and how much time before an investigation commences. One of the most significant, I think, failures this current year in the Maryland State Capitol is that there was legislation not only proposed, but an agreement essentially between the ACLU and the chiefs of police, which doesn't happen very often, where that law enforcement bill of rights would have been amended and I think would have not had precluded a more timely investigation in this matter. But that legislation did not move forward. And so there's actually talk now to call a special session to bring the state legislators back to move that legislation forward. So, you know, you're absolutely right. We should know more sooner. Maryland has a particular dynamic where the law makes this a slower process than it should be.
Well, Mark Schindler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Schindler, who's the Executive Director of the Justice Policy Institute, who previously worked as an assistant public defender in Baltimore's juvenile courts, representing children in delinquency proceedings. He chaired the Juvenile Law Committee of the Baltimore City Bar Association and served on the Maryland Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Justice and the Committee for Baltimore's Children. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the Supreme Court's deliberations today on same-sex marriage. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Solomon, the National Campaign Director of Freedom to Marry and the author of Winning Marriage, the inside story of how same-sex couples took on the politicians and pundits. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Solomon.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Mark, you were in the Supreme Court today where the justices appeared divided over same-sex marriage. And of course, the pivotal vote is Justice Anthony Kennedy, at least that's the conventional wisdom. Let's start with him. What's your sense of where he stands or might stand? I know this is somewhat irrelevant because you never know from these hearings what the rulings are going to be. But Kennedy did say, in terms of the definition of marriage, that is traditional marriage, as it's called, this definition has been with us for millennia, and it's very difficult for the court to say, oh, well, we know better.
Yes, he did say that, but he also said a lot of other things. He said he referred to the time it took from when schools were integrated for African Americans to when the court got rid of the ban on interracial marriage, and so that was applicable to the amount of time from when sodomy laws were eradicated and gay people's respect and dignity was allowed and recognized to today. So, you know, he sort of then, you know, in so saying, he said, you know, that it had been about the same period of time, which indicated to, you know, us, to me, that he thought that there had been enough time and that there was enough support for the you know, for the freedom to marry. But again, you know, it is reading the tea leaves. You know, you can never be sure until you get the opinion. He did say one other thing too that I thought was very important. Our opponent's attorney talked about how marriage isn't about love and commitment and dignity. It's simply about child raising. And Kennedy said, well, what about the dignity of same-sex couples who aren't, you know, who can't naturally procreate, but shouldn't we have dignity and respect for their marriages, for their relationships as well? So I think the things that Kennedy was most passionate about in his words, he was most passionate on our side.
Well, in the case that you just mentioned in that exchange with John Birch then brought up the idea that out of wedlock birth had gone up in the country, to which Kennedy retorted that if that being the case, then it's going to be difficult for same-sex couples to adopt some of these children. So that's always been a part of the conservative argument, that somehow children of gay couples are disadvantaged. But, you know, you cannot legislate love. And my understanding is there's an awful lot of unloved children out there. Their foster homes are cram-packed with unwanted children. And my anecdotal information is that gay parents are just as loving, if not more loving, than the so-called traditional parents. So how do you think that argument was handled? Because to me, that's at the heart of the issue. And I think that...
No doubt about it. It is at the heart of the issue. And it was... You know, it was argued by our side and by the justices who are clearly in our, you know, in our camp on the freedom to marry, that, you know, our opponents allege that somehow marriage for straight people is going to be degraded, even though they have no proof, and they didn't even offer up any proof. They said, well, this could happen down the road sometime. You know, contrast that with the fact that banning gay couples from marriage harms those couples and harms their children in very explicit ways. And that's something that Kennedy didn't talk about too much today, but it certainly has been, it was at the core of some of the things he said in the, you know, in the DOMA hearing 2 years ago and in his opinion. So, I think that contrast, that to me, that contrast is the heart of the matter, this alleged, imagined harm to straight people's marriages versus the real harm to same-sex couples by being denied the freedom to marry.
And the freedom to nurture children. I mean, that's...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's really the ability... I mean, the argument is that, you know, gay and lesbian couples are having, you know, have lots of kids and have, you know, have families, but by denying their parents the ability to marry, you're both harming them in very, you know, in very specific ways through lack of benefits and protections and security, and in ways that are, you know, that are less tangible, not being able to say that that your parents are married, and feeling stigmatized, feeling like your family is stigmatized. Both of those have been very important in Kennedy's comments in the past, and I'm sure that they continue to be.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Solomon, who's the National Campaign Director of Freedom to Marry and the author of Winning Marriage, the inside story of how same-sex couples took on the politicians and pundits. So what did you make then of Chief Justice John Roberts? Because he, of course, still... conservatives in this country are still reeling from the shock that he was a swing vote that upheld Obamacare. My understanding is from today's Supreme Court deliberations, John Roberts seemed to be more on the conservative side as opposed to the liberal side.
It really is hard to read where he is, where he was, based on the questions that he was asking. I wouldn't be surprised if he found a way to vote our way. I wouldn't be surprised if he found a way to vote the other way. So I just don't know. The key, all the lawyers who argue before the Supreme Court tell me the key is to count to five. And we'd love to have the Chief Justice. I think that would be a really strongly to bring closure to this issue, but we need five votes.
So when Chief Justice Roberts said to Mary Buonanotto, the attorney representing the challengers, your side, so to speak, he says, my question is, you're not seeking to join the institution, you're seeking to change what the institution is. What exactly does that mean? And was that elaborated on?
I know what he's saying. My arguments in response is the marriage is never defined by who it excludes. What's fundamental about marriage is love and commitment over the long haul between two committed adults, some of whom are raising families. So, what he was saying was we define marriage by whether it's a man or a woman, and our arguments, and it's not just our argument, it's the argument that now more than 60 judges across the country have sided with over the past year and a half, is that marriage, the fundamental of marriage is about love and commitments, not the the gender of the couple.
So how did Mary Buonanotto answer the question?
It was something to that effect. I was sitting there for 2 hours and 40 minutes, and I don't I don't recall precisely how she answered it, but it was something to that effect, that what's fundamental about marriage is not the gender of the couple, it's about the quality of the relationship.
So I take it the moment of drama was when somebody inside the court stood up and said, if you support gay marriage, you'll burn in hell. And of course, he was quickly ejected at leading.
Yeah, I heard that. He was, he was screaming for some time. They clearly weren't able to silence. I mean, they pulled him out of the courtroom immediately, but even after he was yanked out of the courtroom, you could hear him screaming down the hallway or downstairs or wherever this person was. And I think that just to me shows, and I think that was, even though it was a very distracting moment, I think it was worthwhile for our side in showing, the real zealotry of some of the people who oppose the freedom to marry. And they don't just oppose the freedom to marry. They really oppose gay people.
And was that evident from the crowds outside the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I mean, this draws the people come, especially on our opponent. I mean, on our opponent's side, the people who showed up were just the most extreme, horrible. Had the most horrible messages, it's the people from the Westboro Baptist Church and people who really are like, you guys are going to burn in hell, and the country is going to hell, and so. It's upsetting and disturbing, but I've now been at this for more than a decade, so I'm sort of used to that sideshow.
Well, is there any way that I have a friend who has a magnet on his refrigerator that says something to the effect that, sure, I'm in favor of gays getting married, because why shouldn't they suffer like the rest of us? So, why is there any way that humor can diffuse that kind of poisonous hatred?
Well, it can to regular people, but to these real zealots, they aren't I sort of joke about them, but they aren't really in a mode to be to have a sure. joking relationship. If you think the world is heading off the edge if the court rules a certain way, you're not telling knock-knock jokes about it.
right. Well, but it seems to me, though, that this is so inescapably a political issue. And, you've got the Republicans obviously starting to run in the 2016, and they're clearly, I think what the figures indicate now, that 61% of the country support same-sex marriage. So, according to those polls, the Republicans are running against history and are running against the tide of history.
No doubt about it.
So given that some of the rulings that have come out of this conservative, very Republican court, for example, the letting unlimited money flood into campaigns, which has clearly had a manifest benefit to the Republicans, and voter suppression rulings that have also had a manifest benefit to the Republicans. Without being too cynical, is it possible that the Republicans on this court would want to get the Republican Party off the hook in this election by basically getting rid of this issue? And then the Ted Cruzes of this world could say, well, I'm still against gay marriage, but the highest court in the land has ruled, and I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do about it.
You know, it's hard to judge the motivations of justices, and I certainly look to each of them to uphold high standards and make decisions based on their interpretation of the Constitution. That having been said, there's no question that politically it would be the best outcome for Republican candidates if this issue were decided this June, and it weren't part of the debate over the course of time, because, as you said, then they'd be able to say it's a settled issue. I didn't support it, but I support the rule of law, and it's time to move on.
Well,
and I think if the ruling were to, in the unlikely event the ruling were to go the other way, the issue would become much more intensified, undoubtedly would be an issue in the 2016 election.
Well, just in closing then, you seem to indicate that you expect the ruling to go your way and that same-sex marriage is legalized in this country.
I do. I think based on what I heard today, combined with where the country is, where we now have 37 states in support, not in support, 37 states where same-sex couples can marry, covering 75% of the country, as you said, 61% public support. And then what the court did in denying, deciding not to take up cases earlier on, and essentially giving their green lights to marriages beginning in more than a dozen states, from Utah and Oklahoma and Kansas and South Carolina and West Virginia. So I think that the courts, the country is ready, and both the signals from the court today and a few months ago in October are pretty clear. But again, you never count your chickens before they hatch, and we're going to go right back to work tomorrow continuing to make the case.
Well, Mark Solomon, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Solomon, who's the National Campaign Director of Freedom to Marry and the author of Winning Marriage, the Inside Story of How Same-Sex Couples Took on the Politicians and Pundits. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.